pray together. Lord, may the words of my mouth, the meditations of all of our hearts, be acceptable to you, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. The philosopher Hannah Arendt wrote an incredible book about her observation of the trial of Adolf Eichmann, the Nazi who organized transportation to the death camps in Germany during the Holocaust. When Eichmann was finally put on trial after World War II, Arendt made a fascinating discovery. Eichmann was a civil servant, a very plain and seemingly unideological man. He didn't seem to harbor extreme hatred for Jews. Instead, he actually began his career in Hitler's government transporting Jews to Palestine. He thought of that as helping them achieve their Zionist dreams as a people. Eichmann was a Zionist. Eichmann's movement to an accomplice in mass murder came about not through conspiracy and vitriol. It was an evil born of denial and acquiescence. At one point in his trial for war crimes in Jerusalem, he made an incredible confession. He said that after he came to understand the full extent of Hitler's final solution, Eichmann told the jurors at his trial, he didn't feel horror or indignation. Instead, he felt peace. At that moment, I sensed a kind of Pontius Pilate feeling, for I felt free of all guilt. The country agreed with Hitler. The government was aligned behind the plan. The whole system laid out with great rationality and thoughtfulness. Eichmann reasoned, who am I to have my own thoughts on the matter? Like Pilate, free of all guilt. Eichmann is referring to the story we heard today from the Gospel of John, of Jesus' trial before Pontius Pilate. In Jesus' day, the governors had almost complete control over their local jurisdictions, and their primary goal was to keep order, to keep the region under control of Caesar. Palestine is one of these many vassal states that serve the interests of Rome. Crucifixion was the way to enforce that order. I've often heard people say that the cross is the equivalent of a modern-day electric chair, but that's not quite right. Crucifixions were ubiquitous in the ancient worlds, deaths by torture reserved especially for those who incited rebellion. They were not so much death penalties as they were a form of social control. Bodies on crosses were strategically placed at crossroads to remind the people of the power of Rome to crush their dreams for freedom. Be wary, all of those who stand against the empire. It was James Cone who helped me rethink the place of the cross in our historical memory. He wants us to see that Jesus died not in an electric chair, but on a lynching tree. Every lynching tree is a cross, writes Cone, and every cross is a lynching tree. It's a form of death that cements a social order of terror in the bodies of oppressed people, a way to fortify within human bodies a kind of world order. Like crucifixion, lynching was not done in secret. It was supposed to be a public spectacle. It was announced in advance in order to attract a large crowd. Lynching reminded Black people in the South that white people had the extrajudicial power to keep the order of slavery in place, even if national law had changed. And we know that the charges against lynching victims were so spurious they were absurd. Glancing at a white woman, or being discovered in a consensual relationship with a white woman. Fear of white women's sexual purity and her ability to carry on the white race without tarnish was the predominant theme during Jim Crow. Lynching was a piece of the architecture of power over Black bodies, a reminder that a Black or brown body was never safe an accusation, trial, and execution could occur in an instant. Lynchings were meant to raise the specter that there was no true innocence, because the crime was actually just having a body. In the blackness of the body, a crime a victim could not escape. And as we hear John again today, we discover an equally innocent Jesus, a sham trial announced again and again by Pilate himself. In this scene of the trial of Jesus, Pilate is actually moving inside and outside. He's negotiating with religious leaders and Jesus, and he seems baffled by the very fact that Jesus has been brought to him at all. There is no accusation except this generic word, "He is a criminal." No other explanation is given. And Pilate finds himself trying to hold the middle, looking for the best possible solution to keep everyone happy. First, he wonders, why can't the religious leaders try Jesus by their own laws? Because they want death, and breaking religious law cannot be punished by death. Jesus must die by Roman execution at the hands of Roman officials on a Roman cross. Pilate next tries to see if he can get Jesus to clear up the misunderstanding himself, but Jesus refuses to answer questions in a way that's comprehensible to Pilate. There's ambiguity here, and Pilate answers with this famous phrase, "What is truth?" Without waiting for an answer, Pilate goes back outside, once again trying to get his best to get out of this bind. He offers to release Jesus in the tradition of pardon during the Passover. Ironically, the religious people gathered ask for the release of the murderer and political dissident Barabbas. Even more ironically, Pilate grants the request, condemning to death one who lived a life of nonviolent love, who never spoke against the state, who never raised a sword against Rome. And instead, an insurrectionist goes free. It's a farce. It's a parade of nonsense and cruelty. Jesus clears up any fears that Pilate has about Jesus' role in overthrowing the state. But what we know is that lives like Jesus cannot be allowed to exist. More powerful than swords or guerrilla warfare was the possibility that God was on the side of the poor, was for the Jews, and that God was here among them and that a new world was opening up before them. Jesus' death, James Cone tells us, was a lynching. Lynching is so horrific that we can barely look at it, and yet it is so deeply embedded in our formation as a country. It's a history many of us would like to pretend never happened, one from which we want to turn our heads in disgust. But Pilate reminds me that it takes a lot of good people to let these actions take place. We have to remember that thousands of people would gather to see lynchings take place. Thousands of people stood by and watched. We also know that the majority of lynchings took place in the Bible Belt, instigated by good church-going folk who also felt they had to be realistic about the threat caused by their former slaves. Whites in the South took this on as a religious mission, bearing witness to the God-given superiority of whites over blacks. Hannah Arendt calls this the banality of evil. We hear it all the time. This is just the way it is. I'm just doing my job. Who am I to question my leader or my pastor or my legislator? It's too risky. Who am I to question things? Rowan Williams points out how interesting it is that in the ancient creeds, like the one we said today, only three people are mentioned by name: Mary, Jesus, and Pilate. It's strange, isn't it? Why not Herod? Why isn't he lifted up as the bad guy? He murdered thousands of Jewish babies. Why not Caesar Augustus, who lusts for power led to this massive structure of occupation? Why would the creeds pull up this humble civil servant, simply trying to do his job, to stay in the middle, to keep everyone happy? Perhaps we say the name of Pilate because it's a warning to us, a reminder that evil in its pervasive and haunting form does not always look like white hoods and swastikas. Often evil is ordinary and ordered, pulling us into a posture of complacency, our hands thrown up in the air in resignation. Perhaps we tell ourselves this is what we need for the common good. Perhaps this is what keeps us safe. It keeps us secure. This is what keeps people in line. But we also know on the other side of this warning stands Jesus, the one who refuses to follow the structures and social orders that propagate Rome. Throughout John's gospel, we have heard his strangeness, God's life opening up people to possibilities they cannot fully understand. Unlike Rome's strategy of terrorizing control, Jesus is a slowly unraveling love. It's a love that's incomprehensible, a love that gets swept up in cruelty and torture. And in the end, it's a love that finds a way, a love that offers up no resistance in the face of death. But it's also a love that cannot be kept dead. It's a love that gets up again on the third day, a body that cannot be controlled by princes and governments, not a ghost, not a spirit, but a body that eats and breathes, a body that becomes your body and my body, bound together, the work of God to name what's going on around us, calling us back to follow this Jesus who was killed on a cross, his life beckoning to us and calling us on. Amen.